Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Political satirist Mo Rocca is smart and funny. And right now we're in the home stretch of a presidential race that has been remarkably shy of humor. Take a step back and there is comedy or tragic comedy aplenty in the candidates, the Washington press corps, in lobbyists, first ladies, and maybe even the presidential pets. Tonight on Point, political comedy from the stump to the first doghouse with satirist Mo Rocca. But first tonight, we go to Washington, where the Supreme Court today agreed to hear cases from Texas and Kentucky on the constitutionality of displaying the Ten Commandments in town halls, courtrooms, and other government property. It will be the court's first ruling on the issue since 1980. Vivica Novak covers legal affairs for Time magazine and joins me now from Washington. Vivica Novak, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's good to be with you.
So why has the court resisted stepping into this issue? Why is it getting into it now?
Well, the court decided that there's a conflict in the lower courts in terms of recent rulings on the Ten Commandments and displaying, framed copies or big monuments. In Texas, we have an appeals court who ruled unanimously that it was okay, basically, to display a big monument to the Ten Commandments at the state capitol in Austin. On the state capitol grounds. And in Kentucky, a different court of appeals reached a different conclusion and said that officials were wrong to hang up framed copies of the Ten Commandments in two county courthouses. The Supreme Court tends to take cases that are of, issues that have a big constitutional question at stake when there is a conflict in the lower courts. And this is the first time we've had this in quite a while.
Vivica, the 1980 decision banned the posting of copies of the Ten Commandments in public school classrooms. It would seem that was the law. It was fairly clear then. Does the fact that the court is taking this up again now, does it mean in any way that they're, from the get-go, intent on reversing that 1980 decision?
No, not necessarily, because the court has always treated schools as being somewhat different, because children are, first of all, more malleable, and second, are a captive audience. So what may be right or wrong for the schools is not necessarily what's right or wrong for a basically adult audience in a city or a county or a state.
And what's really at stake here? If the court says, all right, you can put the Ten Commandments in, what's the greater issue on church-state separation? If they say that, does it mean that Christmastime nativity scenes can go back up on the courthouse lawn? What's being decided?
Well, the court has already said that it's okay to put a creche up at Christmas time if there are other sort of secular displays of Christmas and generally the holiday season. That's not necessarily at stake, but it would mean a significant chip in the wall of the separation of church and state. 3 years ago, the court decided not to take up a case on the constitutionality of the Ten Commandments, which was on display in front of a city building in Elkhart, Indiana. And by refusing not to take that case, it basically said it basically upheld the separation, more of a separation. I think the reason it took this case is because of the conflict in the circuits. It's the same court, basically, that there was, 3 years ago. None of the members of the court have changed since then. So I think the betting right now is that, they might split the difference here, but I don't think they're going to totally, take a chip out of that wall.
But they feel like they need to clean up that hodgepodge from the lower courts.
That's right.
When the 2001 case was turned away from the court, there were complaints from Chief Justice William Rehnquist, mm-hmm. from Anthony Scalia, from Clarence Thomas. And Chief Justice Rehnquist pointed out that in the chambers, the court's own Supreme Court chambers include a carving of Moses holding the Ten Commandments. If it works there, why wouldn't it work elsewhere?
Well, that's one of the difficult things here. Certainly there, and in the Department of Justice as well. I mean, there are representations of people holding the Ten Commandments, and it comes down to sort of how prominent is the display, and is it accompanied by any other sort of displays that would put it in context or, you know, make it clear that they're not advocating a particular religion. So it comes down to certain tests that the court has laid out in prior decisions.
Vivica, is the court readable on this? Can you project where they're going to come down on the Ten Commandments question?
Well, as I said, I don't think that they are going to break the wall down and say the Ten Commandments can go up in any circumstances anywhere. It's possible that they will draw some lines here. It's also possible that they will say, you know, Ten Commandments is just going too far, that it should not be on display in these contexts, in the courthouse prominently or prominently on the steps or on the lawn of the state capitol. So I would bet they're either going to split the difference or they are going to rule against the Ten Commandments displays, but I do not think they're going to permit them in all the circumstances.
Well, there will be a lot of attention and political attention focused on this. Vivica Novak, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Vivica Novak is legal affairs correspondent for Time Magazine. She spoke with us from Washington. Three weeks from today, Americans go to the polls. The candidates will dig in and turn up the heat in the last days of a high-stakes campaign that's been remarkably humorless. The stakes are high. The times are serious. But sometimes a little laughter can point to a lot of truth, even in a grueling race. So tonight we're going to step back and get to it with political satirist and pop culture commentator Mo Rocca. His new book is All the President's Pets. Rocca blows the lid off the story of the White House press corps and the presidential pets who steer the nation. We'll take him to the campaign, too. This hour, on-point political funny man Mo Rocca on comedy and the candidates in election 2004. What's your favorite laugh line, absurd or illuminating, of this long campaign? What moment begs for the Mo Rocca take? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is political satirist, actor, comedian, and author Mo Rocca. He is former correspondent for The Daily Show. He covered the Democratic and Republican national conventions for CNN's Larry King. He is a frequent panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. His new book is All the President's Pets, the story of one reporter who refused to roll over. Good evening and welcome, Mo Rocca.
Thank you, Tom. I love being an author. It's a very neat feeling.
Don't you feel august now?
I do, actually, because the thing is that television personalities at best are beloved, but authors are celebrated.
You can have a little self-respect. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is on-point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you with us.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mo.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Authors are also ignored, let me tell you.
They're truth spoken. Mo Rocca, we're going to hear, we want to talk all about the campaign.
Never call me Mo, always call me Mo Rocca.
Mo Rocca, like full branding. All right, full branding is in order. You know, you're writing about presidential pets in this book.
Yes.
We're going to get to that, and we're going to get beyond that, because we've got a lot to cover tonight. But
sure.
I want to get the pets right out here from the very beginning. You and I talked a little bit at the Republican National Convention. We may hear something of that later on. But at that convention, pets did have their moment in the, the Madison Square Garden dull interior gloom up on the Jumbotron when President Bush's Scots Terrier, Barney, was featured in a spoof video that was right up there for all the conventioners to see, featured Karl Rove, Andy Card, Karen Hughes, called Barney Cam 3, a video featuring Bush's closest advisors begging Barney the dog for help winning the campaign. Let's listen.
Hello.
Hey, Ashley, this is Andy Card. I need to talk to Barney.
Sorry, sir. He's very busy right now. He asked that I hold all his calls. He doesn't want to be disturbed.
Tell him I've got this month's supply of snossages, and it just came in.
In that case, hold on one second. Let me get him on speakerphone.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, Barney?
Andy Card.
Barney, you've got to come help. We need you right now, ASAP.
I've got the snossages. They're in. The supply is in. I'll see you in a couple minutes. Bye. Hey, Barney, thanks for coming over so quick. I really need you. We really need you to help. You know, Barney, the campaign trail, we want to put you on the campaign trail. We want you to go state by state, house to house. We need every vote we can get, and you're the one that can do it.
Get a good night's sleep, and remember, Barney, let's win. Let's win. Let's win. Let's win. Let's win.
There it is on the Jumbotron. You had to see it to believe it. Of course, this was the famous video where John Kerry, a stand-in French poodle named Fifi, makes a brief stand-in for John Kerry, a Republican jab. Mo Rocca, what's going on? Your book on presidential pets, the Republican National Convention featuring the presidential pet.
Listen.
What is it with pets?
Well, that clip you showed is a typical exploitation of a presidential pet, used sort of to humanize the president and make him seem even more imposing than he already may seem. And it masks really what presidential pets, through my research, I found have been doing, which is actually influencing real policy. But no president will ever admit that because it will undermine his image of infallibility that he's carefully cultivated. It's an insult to a presidential pet to
be used in
make
this way.
Some sort of furry photo op.
So take us through. We want to get your kind of roll call of all important presidential pets in White House history and the influence they've had. Give us the bullet points here, Mo Rocca.
Well, you know, the presidential pet canon includes about 7 texts. I own 5 of them. You can really get by on just 3 of them if you need to. And so I, for years, have known everything about Washington's jackass royal gift to Andrew Jackson's parrot pole, which is a cursing bird, cursed all throughout his funeral, Woodrow Wilson's nicotine-addicted ram, old Ike, Calvin Coolidge's wallaby. Calvin Coolidge had 33 pets, all the way up to Kennedy's pets, which I show helped defuse the Cuban Missile Crisis, to Sox, Buddy, and now Barney. And all my pets, by the way, are real. And I found sort of undeniable links between presidential decision making and these animals.
The pets are real, but your analysis of their role is sort of out of this world or unprecedented. Let's say George Washington's mule from the King of Spain, as I recall, named.
No, it's not a mule. It's actually the jackass.
Oh, a jackass.
George Washington. Well, George Washington. I steal a lot of this from Richard Brookhiser. I actually sort of advance what the research he's done and the analysis he's done on Washington's character. Washington wanted to create a race of super mules for Mount Vernon. He was a dedicated farmer, and the King of Spain heard about this and sent him a jackass named Royal Gift. Washington named it Royal Gift. And of course, a mule is a cross between a jackass and a mare. And at first, Royal Gift wouldn't even sleep with any of Washington's mares. So Washington had to dangle his female jackasses, also known as Jeanettes, in front of Royal Gift and then do a bait and switch at the last minute. It did work, but throughout it, Royal Gift was just a jerk. I mean, he treated the Jeanettes and mares very poorly. He'd have sex with them and then wouldn't talk to them the next day. He brayed loudly. He'd kick. And Washington compared the behavior of his jackass, Royal Gift, to his steed, Nelson, whom he'd ridden to Cornwallis's surrender at Yorktown.
Good American horse.
Nelson was a wonderful Cincinnatus-like horse. He was dignified. He plowed the fields, never complained. He let little girls brush his mane whenever they wanted to. And he compared the two and said, my God, I have the power right now to be dictator for life. And indeed, Washington did at the beginning of his term. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to show restraint and dignity, just like my steed Nelson, and not like this dissolute, corrupt jackass.
And so a jackass from Spain helps George Washington sort of solidify his worldview. Mo Rocca, stand by. There's a lot more we want to hear tonight.
Sure.
Chuck Beatty, you've got a little story of LBJ swinging dogs by the ears, as I recall.
Oh, yeah, that really created some problems for Johnson. He had 2 beagles, and he turned them around, I think, one at a time. A photographer wanted to photograph them, and he says all they were able to photograph was their asses. So he spun them around and held them by the ear. And that was the picture. It went up, made the front pages, and it brought a firestorm of criticism. The Animal Rescue League, worthy people in editorial offices, Everett Dirksen even complained. And Johnson, on the phone, you can hear it in the tapes, to Mike Mansfield, he said, my God, I was handling beagles when these people didn't even know how to blow their noses. And those dogs weren't crying. No, sir, those were cries of joy.
Presidential pets right there in LBJ's White House. Mo Rocca, author of All the President's Pets.
That's not the full story.
We'll get it all. The story of one reporter who refused to roll over. We're going to look at pets. We're going to look at the press corps. We're going to look at this entire campaign with comedian and satirist Mo Rocca. You can join us. Does the pet make the president? Has the White House press corps played watchdog or lapdog for George Bush? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go into the break with some musical political satire. Special rendition of This Land from the website jibjab.com. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This land will surely vote for me.
You're a liberal sissy.
You're a right-wing nut job.
You're a pinko commie.
You're dumb as a doorknob.
Hey, you got that Botox.
But I still won 3 Purple Hearts.
This land will surely vote for me.
This land was my land,
but now it's our land.
From California to the New York Isle.
What I do?
From the liberal wieners
to the right-wing nut jobs.
This land belongs.
This land belongs.
This land belongs to you and me.
Yeah. Oh, and Dick Cheney, too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with comedian and satirist Mo Rocca about a satirist's dream, the 2004 presidential campaign and the White House press corps, and, as it happens, presidential pets. His new book is All the President's Pets, the story of one reporter who refused to roll over.
I also tap dance. You keep just saying comedian and satirist, but I also tap dance.
Let us not forget the tap dancing, and we've seen it. It's remarkable, especially on deep carpeting. Listeners, you can join our conversation with Mo Rocca. What's your straight line for satirist and tap dancer Mo Rocca?
What I love calls.
What campaign wrinkle do you need the Mo Rocca view on, and do you need a laugh in this campaign? Even now, nearing the 11th hour, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, Rocca, you begged to differ on the details of LBJ's beagle swinging story.
Well, first of all, let me add, by the way, a lot of what Jack Beatty was saying is correct. And indeed, Harry Truman leapt to the defense of LBJ. But Harry Truman, who said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog, treated his dogs very poorly. He exiled both of the dogs soon after they arrived at the White House. My book includes the missing transcript of a conversation between LBJ and him, the beagle. The two beagles were named him and her.
Oh, boy, here we go. Mo Rocca Lane.
It's in August 1964, and shortly before the Gulf of Tonkin resolution happened. And LBJ was struggling with how to interpret mixed signals from sonar that in part detected a ping sound coming from North Vietnamese submarines, supposedly firing at U.S. battleships. Mm. And LBJ had the choice of either saying to the American public, we've been attacked a second time, it had already happened once before, or waiting and saying, you know what, let's just wait. And him, the beagle, in this transcript that I uncovered, and it is annotated by Michael Beschloss, said, you know what, I'm a dog. I have incredible hearing. If I didn't hear it, you know, then no sonar did. And LBJ ignored him, the beagle, and went ahead and ended up getting into a war that escalated and overshadowed all of his domestic achievements. And him had warned him that this would happen. And LBJ had the gall to take it out on him and humiliate him in the public eye by lifting him up by the ears. Him, sadly, later was run over by a car, and her swallowed a rock. And LBJ then got a mongrel named Yuki that Lucy Baines found at a West Texas gas station.
There's nothing like the full story from Mo Rocca.
Well, yes, and Yuki helped negotiate the Voting Rights Act of 1965. He treated his pets abominably for a reason. He was angry at them for supposedly not lobbying him hard enough when they really did.
Now, no disrespect to pets, because as you say, they've steered the nation for a couple of hundred years, but there's much more than that here. You're taking on the White House press corps. You cast yourself in this story.
Sure.
As the reporter who refused to roll over. You say it's a story that's equal parts All the President's Men, Charlotte's Web, and with a little Da Vinci Code, big bestseller thrown in.
Well, the Da Vinci Code, what's a thriller without a villainous albino and some anagrams thrown in? The truth is, like many people, I'd always wanted to star in a thriller with Helen Thomas, the dean of the White House press corps. And in this book, I reveal that she lives underneath the White House in a subterranean lair where she is the keeper of the president. Pet archives. She did enjoy an idyllic girlhood with Sacagawea and an illicit relationship with Millard Fillmore, which is really one of the linchpins of this thrilling, page-turning, pot-boiling, muck-raking blockbuster expose. Helen and I are the only ones with the courage to take on the task of uncovering the secrets of the presidential pets, because, again, no White House, certainly not this White House, wants its authority compromised and wants people to know that it is hardly omniscient or hardly infallible.
But why did it take you? What's up with the White House press corps?
Well, the White House press corps, certainly in the run-up to the war in Iraq, was comatose and post 9/11 and unwilling to challenge the president. There are grave consequences. I mean, whether or not you agree with the war in Iraq, and more and more people don't agree with that, we can all agree that the press did a really lousy job of scrutinizing the White House. Now, I know because I read that book, Boys on the Bus, which is really terrific, and the last person I know to have read it it. And you know, about the 72 campaign. So I know that this is an institutional problem with the White House press corps. I mean, since the time of Teddy Roosevelt, when he invited, you know, reporters into the West Wing, and sort of they became his captives. And, you know, Woodrow Wilson, when the White House Press Corps Association was even formed in 1914, forced them, was thrilled, first of all, that they were organized and they'd be more manageable, and forced them to submit questions before, you know, any press conference, so that he could select which ones he wanted to answer.
But you're describing yourself having wormed inside this press corps with Helen Thomas at your side in this,
yes,
in this marvelous
satire. Bit Harold Ahmad,
Leslie Stahl, and sort of getting her tongue in your ear on the Acela train. Give us some of the more outre, outrageous moments of your undercover work with the White House press corps. What do you see in there?
What I see in there is one of the problems that I encounter in this plot, which I believe to be true, because I spent long enough in a room alone writing it, is that I'm assigned to cover Barney the First Dog, which is an assignment that's not unlikely in the world of cable news. It's a beat that I think is pretty crappy, pun intended. And worse yet, a reporter for Fox News, Lori Du, who is a real reporter, is covered to the same beat, but she's the only one who has access to the dog. So it's really a lousy situation for me.
But these characters that you find yourself with, Ann Coulter, Ann Leslie,
sure,
and Wolf Blitzer, and all the rest.
Andrea Mitchell. Yeah.
Give us some insights that we may not have had
Well, Wolf
ourselves.
Blitzer, for instance, I reveal in this book that Wolf Blitzer from CNN, who is my friend, I actually think he's a really great guy, but I reveal in this book, because I have to, that he's actually a Japanese man. There's no deeper meaning there at all. It's just that I TiVo'd Wolf Blitzer Reports once, his 5 p.m. nightly newscast, and I freeze-framed on his face, and I just stared at it. And after a while, he became Japanese. I don't know how it happened, but he has almond-shaped eyes, and he's kind of Japanesey. And I've always thought of him sort of in a Pat Morita Karate Kid light, sort of, you know, my going over to his place to shellac his floors, trim his bonsais, all in return for lots of canned advice. Wax on, wax off.
A view of Wolf Blitzer that we've never fully seen. So we know you're in there.
Reveal that Ann Coulter is a homicidal maniac too.
Yeah, you've got her going pretty well. But then Ann Coulter does pretty well at that herself. Cast your eye out from that subterranean cavern where where Helen Thomas knows all.
She's so great.
She's so great. She's the one who really asks asked the questions. And look out on this campaign trail for a minute. A number of issues. Having paid attention to pets, you must have paid attention to grooming. What about the hair of these human competitors in this campaign?
Oh, well, actually, that's an interesting question. At one point, John Kerry and John Edwards said that they had the better hair among the candidates, and that's not necessarily true. The vast majority of presidential winners have parted their hair on the left side. John Edwards, who, granted, is a vice presidential candidate, parts his hair on the right side. Only 3 men have been elected and served full terms with right parts in their hair. Those would be Warren Harding, James Buchanan, and Ronald Reagan. And, of course, Ronald Reagan beat a man, Jimmy Carter, who we all know did part his hair on the right for most of his term and then switched over to the left at the last minute. And the only thing worse than a man who parts his hair on the right side is somebody who switches at a moment's notice. It shows an insecurity. So that's one thing. Yeah.
The great part.
Thank God
issue.
None of them are bald. There have only been 5 bald presidents, and the only one in the modern era, Ike. And he had to run against another bald guy and defeat Hitler to win.
But then there's also the height issue. We saw that more clearly. Well, we saw it in both debates so far.
Yeah, George W. Bush is 5'11". John Kerry is 6'4". He would tie Abraham Lincoln as the tallest president if he were to win. Only once in the modern era has the shorter candidate won the popular vote. George W. Bush won the election, was the second candidate in the modern era to win the election, but not the popular vote, as the shorter candidate. The other was when Jimmy Carter defeated Gerald Ford.
Now, there's also the issue of Bulgegate. It's going on in the blogs online. The suspicion or the apprehension that President Bush had something under his jacket between his shoulder blades in the first debate and maybe in the second, and maybe a wire running up to his ear. The suggestion here, this is all nothing proven here.
Well, how the hell else do you think he started talking about Dred Scott?
Well, Dred Scott.
My favorite moment in the second debate was the invoking of the Dred Scott decision. The implication seemed to be that Senator Kerry is for mandating the return of runaway slaves. Is that a position he's taking?
Let's hear just a little bit of that from George Bush in debate number 2.
Another example would be the Dred Scott case, which is where judges years ago said that the Constitution allowed slavery because of personal property rights. That's personal opinion. That's not what the Constitution says. The Constitution of the United States says we're all, you know, it doesn't say that. It doesn't speak to the equality of America.
And right from there, getting back to the Supreme Court and slavery, and we've got John Kerry invoking the Justice Potter standard.
Right, which is very interesting. John Kerry quoted Justice Potter, and George Bush kept saying, you can run, but you can't hide. And he was quoting the Men on Film segment from In Living Color, so it was quite a difference in quotes. When can we talk about Eisenhower's squirrels and John Tyler's gay canaries?
Well, I guess we'll
later. Let's do it later.
Well, all right.
Somebody will call and ask
about
that.
I'm sure that's true. Jack Beatty, it has been not exactly a campaign season of great great comedy.
Sorry, no, I feel badly. I forgot that Jack was there, and I've been hogging.
No, you've been underground in the subterranean lair. But Jack, we saw both Kerry and Bush on Dr. Phil. We heard Dr. Phil ask George Bush if he'd ever spanked the twins.
Yes, and I saw him ask Mr. Bush what he thought about the, quote, plague epidemic, I think, of oral sex in the middle schools, and to see the president's face blanch under that question was really something. It was a low point in presidential what presidents have to suffer. Huh? But, you know, it must be so hard, Mo, to be a satirist in this campaign, since the candidates are specialists in self-satire. I mean, who could top Kerry's "I voted for it before I voted against it"? And Bush, you know, Bush, who hid behind my pet goat on 9/11, Bush strutting like a gunfighter in a B-Western, reminding me of nothing so much as Paul Newman's terminally neurotic Billy the Kid. Do you remember that? In Arthur Penn's The Left-Handed Gun. Bush as this gunfighter. I mean, who could parody anything like that? The candidates done it to themselves.
It's difficult when they fulfill their stereotypes so beautifully. My favorite moment of the debates is afterwards, the awkward mingling moment. But at the second debate, they were sort of swarmed by people. And John Kerry looked like he suddenly found himself by accident in a mob at Dollywood. I mean, he looked so uncomfortable with his surroundings.
Listeners, you can join our conversation tonight. What's your straight line for satirist Mo Rocca? What campaign wrinkle do you need? The Mo Rocca view on World 1-800-423.
Are people buying my book?
Oh, but it's ching-ka-ching-ka-ching-ka-ching.
Okay.
Don't worry. Norma's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Norma. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
I am sitting here laughing so hard on my drive home. I would like Mo's take on President Bush and Charlie Gibson when Charlie said, "President Bush, President Bush," and President Bush just ran over him like a freight train.
Well, I thought it was an interesting – thank you, Norma. It was an interesting moment because, you know, until that point I felt like Bush was getting so kicked around by Kerry that he would be the one that deserved the Purple Heart. But then I thought, well, if that happened and then afterwards Bush ended up killing Charlie Gibson or tackling him, would his Purple Heart be stripped away? I mean, would the president actually be sent to Gitmo for doing that? I mean, it really looked like he was going to tackle the guy. And Bush is in good shape.
But Norman, let me ask you, wasn't Charlie Gibson kind of trying to horn in there a little too much? After all, we tune in to hear the president's, not his follow-up question, don't we?
Right. But Charlie Gibson was the moderator, and I got to say Senator Kerry did stop when Charlie asked him to. And I know President Bush has an authoritative figure, and we all know that, but he should have played to the press.
Stand aside. Let Charlie Gibson have his moment. Norman, thanks very much for calling. Let's get another call here. We've got George calling from Apex, North Carolina. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question for Mo. I'm just wondering if Mo remembers the incident of Harry Truman, the railroad strike, and swinging the dead cat.
Well, I remember the railroad strike. The swinging. Well, the only cat incident I remember with Harry Truman is that Gene Dixon, who lived, I guess, on 19th Street, not far from the White House, had a cat named Mike the Magic Cat. That was the name of the cat. And it went on to the north lawn of the White House. And Truman befriended it for a while. And then Gene Dixon came and asked for her cat back. And I don't know why I know that, but it's actually true. All my pets, by the way, are real, except for Chester Allen Arthur's giraffe, which I allude to in my book. But I will say, by the way, that Chester Allen Arthur burned all of his papers at the end of his term. So while I can't prove that Chet Arthur had a giraffe, no one can prove that he didn't.
And, George, what about that swinging cat? What do you know about it?
What is that about?
Well, I am Googling right now, and I'm trying to find the reference, but there was a railroad strike in 46, and Harry Truman, I think he made some comment to a reporter once about how he could go outside and swing a dead cat, and he wouldn't hit anybody who was being oppressed by the railroads or something. It was a kind of a typical, you know, I'm the boss, and what I say matters kind of a comment.
I could swing a cat, and I will if I want it. Morrock is going to have to get down to that subterranean lair and chase that down. George, thanks very much for your call. Everybody's tried now and then to joke during this campaign. Here's John Kerry with Dave Letterman. Just before the debate, tries to joke around with Letterman about the negotiations that went into deciding the rules of the three debates. Not entirely successful.
I came here tonight to lower the expectations for these debates, David. So
you just settled on three debates, is that what I understand?
We settled on three.
Mm-hmm. Now, originally one of the positions was, who wanted to stand? You wanted to stand? Bush wanted to sit?
I wanted to, I didn't care, stand or sit. I wanted to have John Edwards stand. Dick Cheney wanted to sit for the whole debate.
Yeah, and they compromised, and now they're going to squat? Is that what I heard?
Now what's going to happen is, no, we compromised, and George Bush is going to sit on Dick Cheney's lap.
Well,
there it is, Mo Rocca, you're the expert. There's John Kerry's big punchline. What do you think?
It doesn't work for me. The model for how politicians should behave on these shows actually is Mike Bloomberg. I'm serious. Mike Bloomberg has been on the Letterman a few times, and when he delivers a top 10 list, he does it in such a stiff, just a humorless way that it ends up coming off, first of all, as very funny, and you kind of respect him because he's not trying to be anybody that he's not. There's nothing worse than these guys falling over themselves to come on comedy shows and show how human they are. I mean, you know, and I know this is something that politicians have always done to try to be the common man, be the regular Joe, and this is just an extension of that, whether they're throwing a pitch out at a baseball game or – you know, putting on silly costumes. But I mean, it's kind of unnerving.
Not working for Mo Rocca. Jack Beatty, is there just not room this time for the left? Even in 2000, there were jokes before Florida, jokes before 9/11 and Iraq. Is it too late in the day for jokes?
Yes, in a word. It's not a funny time. I mean, the world is grim and getting grimmer. And I think that the impulse to be jokey, which candidates must feel that they must have to sort of war against for fear that they're going to just seem, and I've seen Bush actually smile at the most inappropriate moments as if he's under the influence of some secret mirth he won't share. But it may be that he's thinking of something funny to say and says, oh, I can't say it, but has a funny laugh. Or it may be that that voice in his ear has just told him a good joke.
Or it may work for him anyway, Jack. Everybody wishes that we could have a laugh. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight with Mo Rocca, author of All the President's Pets, the story of one reporter who refused to roll over. You can join the conversation tonight. Have the comics told us more than the commentators this season? And what's the campaign moment, theme, slogan that most begs a satirist for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
There's Taylor, there's Tyler, there's Gilmore, and there's Hayes. There's William Henry Harrison.
I died in 30 days.
We are the adequate, forgettable, occasionally
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with comedian and satirist and tap dancer, we do not forget, Mo Rocca, about a satirist's dream, the 2004 presidential campaign and the White House press corps, and as it happens, presidential pets. Mo Rocca's new book is All the President's Pets, the story of one reporter who refused to roll over. You can join us tonight. What campaign wrinkle do you need the Mo Rocca view on? What's funny this time? What can humor illuminate that we might be missing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tim is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. I just wanted to point out, I'm surprised the media hasn't grabbed onto this more, and it was probably the most painful attempt at the candidates to make humor when George W. Bush in the last debate said, you want to buy some wood?
After John Kerry's timber comment, we'll get Mo Rocca on that. Let's listen to that for just a minute. Tim, listen with us.
And you know why he gets that count? The president
got $84 from a timber company that he owns, and he's counted as a small business. Dick Cheney's counted as a small business. That's how they do things. That's just not right.
I own a timber company? That's news to me. Need some wood?
That sounds vaguely like a sex offender. I'm sorry, just that line just really bothered me, that last one.
It turns out George Bush did own a little bit of a timber company, but how do you rate that? Quick on his feet or no?
How do I rate it? I think, different when you're – people say that when you're up close to the president, he seems really natural and people feel very comfortable with that. And, yeah, I mean, you know, it was an attempt to be natural. Yeah, maybe it works.
Tim in Appleton, what do you say? Did the president charm you with his offer of some wood?
No, not at all.
Gross.
Yeah, I thought he sounded pretty stupid when he was saying it. You know, he's trying to be funny, but it just came off as totally almost inappropriate, like Mo says.
Well, come on. Regular guy, he's trying to connect with the American public.
Please, in the first debate, he talked about putting a leash on his daughters. Okay, and now he's offering people his wood.
But that was a father saying you can't keep.
Which makes
teenagers.
It even worse.
Well, look, Tim, thanks for your call from Appleton. Let's get another call here. Montana's calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Montana. You're on the air.
Hi, Mo. You may remember me. We used to work together at Dr. Seuss' show. Do you remember that?
Oh, right. Of course. Okay, great.
I actually had a question about that comment in the first debate about Bush putting his daughters on a leash and Kerry saying he had learned not to do that. And as an expert in pets and politics, I was wondering if you think that this indicates something about, you know, Bush's respecting his dogs more than his daughters or, you know.
Oh, Montana, that's not fair. That's not fair.
Well, I will say that putting leashes on pets is important because Benjamin Harrison didn't have a leash on his goat, his Whiskers, and one day it dragged the kids off onto Pennsylvania Avenue, which is sort of a fun little presidential pet story. No, I guess so. He wants to put a leash on his daughters but not on his dog. I'm not sure. Maybe they have a little electronic fence or something around the White House the dog, not the daughters.
We got it. Montana, thanks very much for your
thanks,
call.
Thanks, Montana.
Good hearing from you, Montana. Maraca, a number of things have come up. Windsurfing has come up as a real problem for John Kerry here, and the Republicans have had some fun with it. Does that give you a belly laugh?
Every campaign, it's like the wide world of sports watching these guys. I want a montage at the end of all the sports that they do. And Bush definitely has the edge. I mean, it's better to, you know, to bowl and to clear brush, which obviously isn't a sport. And jogging's very everyman. I mean, jet skis and windsurfing. It's Chris Matthews actually said it's too JFK Jr. and not JFK enough.
And what about the body language of these two guys? Jack was talking about President Bush on the deck of the aircraft carrier, that kind of Texas, what do you call it, the swagger that we call walking in Texas. John Kerry's body language, how do you compare them, Moraga?
Well, I mean, John Kerry has a straighter posture. I mean, and Bush has a little bit of unless it's the mic pack thing, I'm not sure. Body language, I guess Bush is a little bit more... I don't want to sound rude about it, but a little bit maybe more primal or something. I mean, I don't mean like simian. I mean, he's, you know, he's a little, but Kerry maybe walks a little too straight. I'm not sure about that. Yeah. Kerry sometimes looks like kind of a snooty French waiter. I expected him at the beginning of the first debate to read the specials to us, you know, and to tell us that there was no creme fraiche tonight.
And in the St. Louis debate, the second ones, when they were on the same floor, kind of gladiator in the round with just that little piece of masking tape to keep them apart, did you fear any crossing of the line physically there,
well,
at Morocco?
Well, I was hoping that there would be something, but no, it wasn't as menacing as Al Gore was with George Bush at the same debate last time.
When he flushed inside.
Right. Well, no, he flushed inside at the first debate, but at the second one, he was circling him like a cat, like Al Gore kept invading George Bush's space.
There we are. Back to that pet stuff again. Ven is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Ven. You're on the air.
Teddy Roosevelt had a one-legged rooster.
Well, take that, Ven, and put it in your pipe and smoke it. Ven, help me.
Hi. I'm sure everyone's seen 9/11, and my question to Mo is, I was wondering what he thought about the several comic moments in Fahrenheit 9/11 portraying President Bush. It was more of a comedy than a serious film, so wondering what he thought about it.
You mean like the golfing moment?
Yeah, the golfing moment, and where he actually in Texas, he's trying to tell people how he pulls out weeds from his garden or something. And also, actually, when he was sitting in Florida, the 7 minutes where he waited after he heard about the 9/11 attacks, it was pretty. There was some comic moment in there, and I was wondering what if he had.
Then we've got it's a rough line, but Mo Rocca, Michael Moore's.
Well,
Fahrenheit
first of all,
9/11,
my pet.
Please.
Now, first of all, My Pet Goat isn't that interesting a book. You actually learn very little about goats by reading that book. And also, I kind of resent the demonization of golf. I'm not a big golfer myself, but come on. You know, Ike golfed. A lot of presidents have golfed. Warren Harding, okay, he wasn't a great president, but Taft golfed. Like, since when has golf equaled being diabolical? No, I thought I think Michael Moore was smart to lighten up the movie with some comic moments. I mean, I think he's a funny guy.
Anathia is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Anathia. You're on the air.
Hi there, Mo. I love you, and I'm so glad to hear
you.
That your comments about reality TV and that your comments about politics are just as good. Or insightful or funny.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your observations about the Bush daughters and their speeches, in particular the speech at the RNC, and their observations about GAMI.
Yeah, I am actually big fans of the Bush girls. I'll tell you, the Bush twins to me, and I say this with all respect, are total porn stars. And I mean that, and let me explain what I mean by that. And remember, Jenna Jameson's on the bestseller list, so porn is mainstream now. And what I mean is that the Bush girls have a very particular way of speaking. When they speak, the way they speak is totally detached from what they're saying, which is vintage adult film talk. Like, for instance, I remember when they said during their speech at the RNC, "Our parents have pet names for each other. They call each other Bushy." And then my favorite line was when Jenna the Blonde said, and this was in reference to the Kerry girls' speech when they talked about John Kerry pulling his hamster out of the Mekong Delta, where whatever that whatever happened there. And
off the Boston
Jenna
pier.
Said, the blonde said, "We had a hamster too. He died." And I was hoping that Barbara the Brunette would then say, "Our father put him to death as governor of Texas."
Unfair. But how about those Kerry girls? They were up there on stage as well.
The Kerry girls are too do-gooder for me. I'm kind of tired of wives and daughters, aren't we all? And so I just want them to just play the frivolous roles that they should, the extraneous roles. Like, you know,
they brought up hamsters. How much more extraneous can you be? I did mouth to mouth for Jay Leno on Hamster Mode.
I want to hear more about what happened with Teresa Hines' pumpkin spice cookies, which got trounced by Laura Bush's cookies, her snickerdoodles or something in the family circle contest. Look, politics is so personality driven, and I guess it always has been. I mean, our president is both head of state and head of government, so we impose all these fixations on them. I want the wives and daughters to just. I mean, it's fun to pick them apart because they've put themselves up for it. I'm partial to Teresa Hines just because I'm convinced that. Well, if Kerry wins, she won't be first lady. We'll have to give her the title Empress of America. And I want her to ride around on an elephant. I think it would be really cool. And if she tore down the East Wing, which is the first lady's domain, and built a biosphere there for all of her favorite endangered species.
It's possible
like
she could afford it. More pets than ever.
That would be great. Teresa Hines with a toucan perched on her shoulder.
Now, you were a little tough on the Bush daughters. John Kerry needs a little more attention here, I'm afraid, on the tough side. Here in the St. Louis debate, and where the audience, I thought, was just terrific. Their question's so straightforward and right to it. And he's asked by an audience member to answer a question in clear, simple language about, you know, pledging not to raise taxes of the middle class. Senator Kerry has a little trouble. Let's listen.
Senator Kerry, would you be willing to look directly into the camera and, using simple and unequivocal language, give the American people your solemn pledge not to sign any legislation that will increase the tax burden on families earning less than $200,000 a year during your first term?
Absolutely. Yes. Right into the camera. Yes. I am not going to raise taxes. I have a tax cut, and here's my tax cut. I raise the child care credit by $1,000 for families.
Simple, clear language, yes, right into the camera, yes. But then off we go. Mo Rocca, there was a moment.
Sure, it becomes a treatise. It's a phone book length answer. It's harder to find stuff to laugh at with John Kerry, and I'll tell you why, because it, for the same reasons that it's hard to find reasons to proactively vote for him as opposed to voting against Bush, because he doesn't really put himself out there. I mean, I feel like it's kind of been, from his point of view, kind of a defensive campaign, I think. I mean, I think he realizes that for a lot of Americans, there's a lot of anger at Bush, so he doesn't really there's nothing. The brilliance of his campaign so far is that nobody really knows anything about him still.
What do we know about his pets? You're a specialist Senate on years. That.
His pets?
Yes.
Well, I know about his German Shepherd, which is a real problem. He doesn't have a poodle, but he has a German Shepherd, which is you know, a thoughtful, deliberate breed. It was it comes off as aloof sometimes. It's slow to act. It was bred by Captain Max von Steffenitz for German World War I troops, so it has a strong military background. But the problem with this dog is it's named Kim. It's a male dog named Kim, which isn't going to fly in swing states.
It's
like
kind
Missouri
of a flip-floppy thing there, you're saying.
Yeah, and worse yet, it's spelled C-Y-M. I mean, that's got wacky billionaires written all over it. I mean, she pulled it out of her favorite Isaac Dinesen novel. And no one in states like Michigan or Missouri is going to vote for somebody who let his wife name the dog for him. I mean, and other than that, he has a Douglas Brinkley told me in his research that he found that they have a canary also. I didn't know that. I guess it's to capture the minor vote to seal that up.
Let's get one more call. Ariel's calling from Los Angeles. Hi, Ariel. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling on behalf of my good friend Diana in Massachusetts, who wants to marry Mo Rocca.
Oh,
well,
no.
Great.
He's in a subterranean lair.
That's right. Well, if you don't mind living in a subterranean lair, the lighting is through whale oil, which can scald if you spill it on yourself. Send all you have to do is there's documentation available on the web, and just print it out, sign it, make sure that you have a notary public, stamp it, and then send it in to me, because I definitely might very well be interested.
Ariel, we all feel the magnetism, no doubt, but what is it that your
has
girlfriend
she bought
sees
the book?
In Mo Rocca?
That matters. Has she bought the book?
Ka-ching from what does she see in Mo Rocca, Ariel?
She's listening right now, and she says that you have a really sexy, awkward voice, and that's the basis of the attraction, really.
I love that. That's awesome. That's great. I'll make sure that I become even less fluent in my speech.
a sexy, awkward voice. Does that work in running for the – Ariel, thanks for your call. Good luck to your girlfriend.
Coolidge also had a bobcat named Smokey.
Smokey.
Taft had a cow named Pauline. As did William Henry Harrison, whose cow was named Suki.
Mo Rocca, on the other side of November 2nd, Who's going to be laughing? Anybody?
I don't know. I think there's room to laugh. I mean, are people as angry as we think they are?
I don't know. You tell us.
Well, no, that's a question for Jack in the Atlantic Monthly. I mean, I write about animals.
Cover story coming.
No, I don't write. I write about animals. That's my bailiwick.
Well, you did. I mean, you have. But for the rest of your
Grant
life?
Grant had some vile-tempered gamecocks.
How do we know they were vile-tempered?
Because there's a whole tradition of vile-tempered birds in the White House. And I mentioned Andrew Jackson's parrot poll already.
Well, shouldn't gamecocks be vile-tempered? I mean, they're supposed to fight. Like candidates.
I suppose they should be. I only know what I read and write.
Harding had a pet
forge.
Named Nan Britann, and he wrote her, "I love you clothed, but naked more."
And she wrote that in the closet while she was having sex with him.
What species was this? Jack, what species was this pet? Nan Britann.
Nan Britann. Yes, she was. She was, in fact, a female. But he treated her like a pet, and he called her my pet.
Are there any more
pet.
Questions coming?
But what species? I didn't hear it. I have to know.
No, Harding had an Airedale named Laddie Boy.
Naked Pets, Mo Rocca, you get us going, and we thank you for that. We appreciate you joining us tonight.
It's over?
I'm afraid that's it. I mean, we'd love to go on. Mo Rocca,
John Quincy Adams had an alligator in the East Room. It was a gift of the Marquis de Lafayette.
All the President's Pets, the story of one reporter who refused to roll over. He had it in the East Room. We'll think about that as we sign off. Mo Rocca, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, thanks as always for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Yeah, thank you. You're welcome. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.